91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's program starts with word about a cool group that seeks to cut down on unsightly trash. They're volunteercleanup.org. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. These trusty souls may slog into mangrove swamps and patrol neighborhood shorelines and waterways to pick up trash. And what's picked up onshore doesn't wind up as ocean debris. And more, Linda Gassenheimer relishes her dessert favorite with news about this weekend's Fairchild Tropical Garden Chocolate Festival. The garden's horticulture director, Richard Campbell, and acclaimed chef, Alan Susser, both relate how the scrumptious delight is grown, refined, and made delicious. Then Fred Tasker picks great wines to go with it. Topical Currents next, after the news.
And we return 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman with you on this Thursday afternoon. Well, we begin the hour with the story of a South Florida environmental outreach program. It's volunteercleanup.org. And we're here with its co-founder and director, Dara Schoenwald of Miami Beach. She's a cultural anthropologist and an active eco-activist.
Volunteer Cleanup's main focus is trash, especially the rubbish, which blights neighborhoods, shorelines, and waterways. If the stuff isn't picked up locally, well, it's likely to wend its way to the sea and become part of the ocean's plastic and trash debris crisis. So welcome, Dara Schoenwald, and thanks for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
And, you know, for congratulations, what a great effort. So talk about you and Dave Dobler, who are co-founders, and how cleanup, volunteercleanup.org just came to be.
Sure. So it basically started, just as we were engaging in our regular activities as Miami Beach residents. We enjoy the water, we kayak, we paddleboard, and became aware of the amount of marine debris right in our local neighborhood. And we were devastated by that. So slowly we started picking up trash on our kayaks and our paddleboards, and then organizing small groups to do the same. Before long, we realized there were quite a number of residents that had the same concerns, and small groups that were going out on doing shoreline cleanups, and a lot of organizations that were hosting cleanups, but there was no central way to really connect them. So we created the website volunteercleanup.org as a community resource and a platform to connect anybody who was hosting a local cleanup and to find the volunteers that were interested in joining one.
Where is most of this stuff coming from? Is it being tossed from cars? Or?
So I would say about 80% of the marine debris that we see in the marine environment is land-based. Many of it comes from the street level. So if people litter intentionally or unintentionally, if things blow out of garbage bins or if they litter, it often times finds its way into the marine environment right through the storm. Storm drains, right? So they may.
Oh, so it's a storm runoff.
Yeah, it could be, and of course, there's also from boating, stuff that blows in the wind. But 80% of the marine debris is land-based; comes from the land.
Do you think climate change and all of the rain and flooding is having an impact on this and exacerbating the problem?
I would say it's potentially the other way around. So the relationship between marine debris and sea level rise is threefold. One is that the litter can flow through the storm drains and clog the system there, and that contributes to the flooding, right? So we have many examples where we found the drains completely clogged from the kayak, and as soon as we began to pull the plastic bags out, the water was flowing again. So definitely the amount of trash in the system when it's not maintained regularly can be a contributing factor to the flooding. The second example I would say is that when the tides are really high, it washes the marine debris back out to the sea. So when it's on the shoreline, that's when we have the opportunity to remove it. When the sea come up, it washes out. And the most important factor is all of the production to produce these single-use plastics. The process of producing the items that we find on the shoreline is made through fossil fuels, and the burning of those fossil fuels creates emissions, carbon dioxide, and that is what is contributing to sea level rise and climate change.
I was amazed by the tonnage that's collected. Do you then haul these to landfills?
So it depends on what the facilities are at the park. A lot of the shoreline cleanups that we do are at state or city county parks. If they have trash bins or recycling bins on site, we utilize those. Many of them do not have recycling, and so we ask our volunteers, we haul it back home. We've actually purchased a little trunk that goes on our car that we can attach with a trailer hitch so that we can haul away all of the recycling and make sure that it's properly disposed of.
You have kind of a very multi-prong approach to dealing with this problem. Tell us the branches, and stressing the education one, because that seems like really the most important for children and adults.
Sure. So we feel very strongly that everyone has a role to play in this problem, right? Individuals can assume personal responsibility, making sure that they dispose of their trash properly, and also doing their best to reduce single-use plastics, things like carrying a reusable water bottle, bringing your own bags to the store, refusing a straw at the bar. So there's a lot of simple things we as individuals can do. Of course, education is a huge component of that. We're working on a large outreach program to middle schools and fifth graders to educate them early on the problem and to make sure that they're making appropriate changes in their own lifestyles and behaviors as they become adults. And of course, government has a role to play, right? There's infrastructure improvements. We've been very successful in the city of Miami Beach with a styrofoam ban and imposing some stricter fines on littering, and also piloting these gratings at the storm drains that prevent the trash from flowing in the first place. So government has a role to play.
What is the styrofoam ban?
So the styrofoam ban is in the city of Miami Beach. Restaurants and bars may no longer use styrofoam as to-go packaging or for the little cafecitos. You cannot have styrofoam coolers. The styrofoam cooler ban has been implemented for quite a while. You cannot have styrofoam coolers on the beach. Walgreens, CVS, Publix, they can no longer sell styrofoam products in the city of Miami Beach.
You know, the laws are great, but are they being enforced? And what are the penalties?
That's a great question. I mean, I think enforcement, can be tricky, especially for littering, right? If you to catch somebody in the action mm-hmm. of littering is problematic. We've got a very active number of volunteers and citizens who are concerned about these issues, and then they can use, in the city case of the city of Miami Beach, they can use the eGov app to report any stores or bars or restaurants that are still. There's an eGov app, a mobile phone app that you can use to report any instances of noncompliance for these ordinances.
And then what are the penalties? So you report somebody littering and sometimes you see, $50 fine or whatever. Is that the extent of the penalty?
Yeah, so there are fines.
Fines.
And then also, the city who regulates permits, so whether you have a sidewalk cafe, that could potentially also be an area where the city has some control over who they give out licenses to.
Well, obviously the organization is volunteer-centric, but is it very rigorous work? Do some people like it in waiters? And
my partner and co-founder of Volunteer Cleanup, he actually, just as his holiday gift, requested waiters.
Fall over in them, you can drown.
most of the work that we do is on the shoreline. There, of course, are safety precautions. We give out gloves to all of the volunteers. There's always a water cooler on site so that they can refill their bottles. We have gloves and first aid kits. We've never really had an incident in our work. We take care. There are some areas that have, mangroves or rocky shorelines. Most of our events last about 2 hours long, so it's, a good amount of exercise and a good amount of time in the sun. So
the gloves, of course, you could run across something that's really nasty and spoiled.
Glass, sharp objects, hypodermics.
There are sharp objects. We do occasionally find needles. There are rocks, so there are some hazards. But we take as many precautions as we can to
what
protect
about,
our volunteers.
Like when the beach is filled with man-o-wars or jellyfish? I mean, I see that often, at least on up on the northern part of it. I mean, those are dangerous, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So you just work with all those things. You've learned how to...
Yeah, yes, we do. I mean, our organization focuses much more so on the shorelines that are inland and off of the bay. We don't do as much work on the beaches because they happen to be fairly well maintained as tourist destinations. You'll find some straws, you'll find a ton of cigarette butts on the beaches, but they're cleaned every day, they're sifted. The mangrove areas and the rocky shorelines on the bay are by far and large the most problematic because that's where all of the debris collects and gathers.
What are some of the worst areas for shore trash? With the material you gave us, I saw like some really nasty photos of government cut there mm-hmm. where the cruise ships are.
Yeah. That's a problematic area. Right here, close to where we are, we frequently take student groups to Albert Pallet Park. So that's a little park maybe people don't know by name, but right when you come over the Julia Tuttle Causeway, as soon as you hit Biscayne Boulevard on the right-hand side, the way it's situated, the way the tide patterns work there, just there's a tremendous amount of trash. So that's a location we go. The Venetian Causeway, when you're heading west towards the toll booth, which nobody can do at the moment, but if you go there by foot,
that's another program.
Yeah,
if you go there by foot or by scooter, just before the toll bridge on the left-hand side, when you're facing downtown, it is completely filled with styrofoam. It was the most heartbreaking sight. From far away, it looks like pebbles or rocks, and as soon as you get close, you realize they're all individual tiny pieces of styrofoam.
So, how do you organize these cleanups and tell us what a typical cleanup is like and how people can volunteer?
Okay, great. That's a great question. So as I said, the website itself is a community resource, and it's a platform for anybody who wants to organize a cleanup. So when you go to the website, you have two options. You can sign up to volunteer, or you can host your own cleanup. Anybody looking to volunteer can go to the website. They enter in their email address and their zip code. Every Monday, they will receive an email blast, which will list all of the different cleanups happening over the next 2 weeks within a 10-mile radius of where they live.
And it's volunteercleanup.org. No spaces, no hyphens, no nothing.
Nope. Okay. And right on the website, you'll see the Get Notified. You can also just visit the site regularly and see what are the upcoming cleanups. If you want to host an event, similarly, you go and you register on the website and you use the options and the utilities there to create your own event, which gets posted. We have a number of local organizations that are hosting regular cleanups and posting them to our website. We've got ECOM, the Environmental Coalition of Miami and the Beaches, the Surf Rider Foundation, the museum volunteers at the Museum of Science as a regular host, Debris Free Oceans. There's a lot of partner organizations that are creating and hosting their own cleanups.
What about national, like Ocean Conservancy, or do they also host local cleanups?
They don't host local, but we are their county organizers. So International Coastal Cleanup Day is a once-a-year event in the end of September, and we are the county coordinators for that single day of service. So they have designated different organizers in various areas. On that day, we coordinate up to 40 different shoreline cleanups all throughout the county.
Why do they only have one of those?
Well, that they have a single event to draw attention, you know, to the magnitude and the severity of the situation, and they use that to compile an annual report. It's the annual index of marine debris. But they support and encourage people to lead cleanups all the time, which is exactly what we are doing. So we kind of think of ourselves as International Coastal Cleanup, you know, every day.
We're speaking with Dara Schoenwald. She's a cultural anthropologist, eco-activist, and social entrepreneur. She's the executive director and co-founder with Dave Dobler of volunteercleanup.org. A short break, and we'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with Dara Schoenwald of Miami Beach. We're talking about the volunteercleanup.org organization. And if you'd like to join in with a comment or question, that's easy enough. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576.
Our email is radio@wlrn.org.
Dara, talk a little bit about the extent of plastic ocean debris in that crisis, where there's huge islands in the oceans. Some of them are as big as the state of Maine or so.
Yep, twice the size of Texas is
twice
one
the
of the
size
stats.
Of Texas.
And there was a recent report that just came out this week that says by 2050, the oceans will be filled with more plastic than fish.
Hmm.
So that's a little bit of the magnitude. I mean, here locally, when we do shoreline cleanups, a single event in a very small park with a handful of volunteers, we will routinely remove 300 to 500 pounds of debris in a single event. On International Coastal Cleanup Day, where we had many events happening simultaneously, we removed 18,000 pounds of debris.
So the ocean currents swirl those things around, and eventually they all get together. So it's this huge mass.
Correct. Yep. There's a number of gyres. You know, Great Pacific Garbage Patch is one of the gyres that people often talk about, the islands of trash.
How is volunteer cleanup funded?
So we are funded through our fundraising activities. We participated in Give Miami Day, where we raised a fair amount of money. We also got corporate sponsorships for International Coastal Cleanup Day. So we generated some funds there, and we're launching a new program for corporate sponsorships. Essentially, any local company that wants to support the organization and see what is happening with the problem, we will coordinate a day of service for the corporation, and for every day of service that they hire us to do, we will do a similar outreach program with the school and put a water bottle refill station in the school.
So if a corporation wants to have you, just explain what one would do.
Sure. So we did an event. This is before we officially launched the program, but Stantec is a local company, their architectural firm, and they wanted to have a day of service as a company. So they contacted us. We took 80 of their employees over to Morningside Park right off of 55th and Biscayne and coordinated a day of service for them where we give them a little introduction to the problem of marine debris and then guide them on executing a shoreline cleanup where we remove the debris and we separate it. And then we also tally and quantify it in conjunction with the procedures laid out by the Ocean Conservancy for International Coastal Cleanup Day. We quantify everything that we find, how many bottles, how many bags, how many straws, and we enter that into the Ocean Conservancy database.
You get a lot of monofilament fishing line?
Oh, yeah, too? Absolutely. Yep.
And hooks probably,
and
too.
And hooks, yeah. The top 10 items, they're high up there, but they're not the top 10. But
what are the top 10?
The top 10 are bottle caps, so the plastic or metal, cigarette butts, beverage bottles, which can be plastic or cans, food wrappers, straws, grocery bags, or other types of plastic bags.
Let's
go ahead.
Take a quick phone call or two. Randy in Coral Gables, hey there.
Hi, how are you? I think it's admirable that there's a company, you know, out there collecting plastic bottles, but I think people miss the forest for the trees in that the companies that actually manufacture those bottles are not held responsible for the life cycle of their products. So companies like Coca-Cola and Zephyr Hills, all those kind of companies, they're not held responsible. They can make containers that are biodegradable. They're just not doing it. They can make it out of hemp. They can make it out of a lot of different materials. And that's really where the focus should be. We should put the onus of responsibility on the manufacturers. Mm-hmm.
Dara?
Yes, I would agree with that to a certain degree. I think everyone has a role to play, right? There's individual personal responsibility. We really don't need bottled water, right? That's just, it's been a big a success of marketing to convince us that we need to buy water in plastic bottles and to pay for it, right? So I think individuals have a role to play. We use the cleanups as a way to raise awareness for the problem. We are not naive to think that we can single-handedly remove all of the plastic out of the ocean, but we use it as a way to bring attention to the problem and to highlight the things that, you know, we can each do. So certainly individual responsibility is a role, as well as businesses, restaurants, and government.
Yeah, government. And is the government, I mean, you're saying that you're working with Miami Beach. What are other municipalities doing?
Yeah, so we actually have a bill that we're working on at the state level to allow coastal communities to regulate plastic bags. So currently there's an existing law at the state level, a preemption law, that says nobody can on their own make any regulations about plastic bags. So we're working with our representatives in the state level, and we've had a number of local cities sign on in support of that bill. So that's something we're looking forward to, at least allowing individual municipalities as coastal communities to make their own laws about plastic bags.
And we'll take another caller. We've got Olivia in Florida City. Hey there.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
So I'm calling today from Florida City. I'm off of work, but I would normally be driving down to Key Largo, to Gilbert's, where I work there. And it's a resort on the water, and it's a great place, but we do serve our stuff in plastic cups. And so I'm always thinking about ways that I can take my own individual, you know, responsibility here and clean up in my area. And so I just really appreciate you coming on today and telling us about this volunteercleanup.org, because I've been trying to figure out how I was going to be able to kind of outreach to my boss and to the restaurant and to, you know, set up something where we can all go around our area and clean up the plastic that we're helping to put into the ocean, you know?
So maybe you can set something up with the volunteercleanup.org.
That's great, Olivia. Dara?
Yeah, please use our website as a resource to create your own event, and we're happy to consult on best practices and guide you in any way we can so that you can be successful in leading your own cleanup event.
Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You know, that brings up a good point, Olivia mentions. We do have a lot of outdoor dining here in South Florida, more than probably, you know, and it's year-round most of the time. That does create a problem. They don't like to put glasses outside because they can break. So, any ideas?
Yeah, there's a number of alternatives to glass. We frequently carry to cocktail parties and other places we go. We have our own stainless steel cocktail cup. It's a Clean Canteen is the brand, and there's been two organizations that have produced their own. Surf Rider has one, and then also Debris Free Oceans. They're super cute, but there's no reason that restaurants and bars can't use something that is reusable, that doesn't break. I mean, there's even BPA-free plastic cups that you can use and wash and reuse. So there's a number of alternatives, including stainless steel.
Would you have any idea of if some of this debris is coming from the water itself with recreational boaters?
Well, of course.
Definitely. Yes, for sure. As you know, probably about 20% of that. I mean, if you visit Monument Island, you know, after the weekend, it's a mess. And, you know, there's a good sense that it's mostly the boaters that come there to spend the day that trash the island. Some, of course, is unintentional. There's, you know, going very fast in the ocean, stuff blows around. So there's intentional and there's unintentional litter that gets into the oceans.
It's good because on your website, you use photos. So you photograph all this stuff, right? And I think the photographs are an important part because it is worth a lot more than just hearing, you know, we did 500 pounds, we did, you know, 16 tons, whatever. Seeing it is really powerful.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why we encourage people to come out on a cleanup. You know, not only are you going to feel good that you did something to give back and meet great people who are, you know, share your concerns, but seeing it is really important. And this is why we focus on the outreach program with schools. I know the fifth graders that we're bringing out on cleanups, when they see what we see, they are not going to litter. They are going to think twice about the amount of single-use plastics that they use. They're going to reconsider their behavior. So experiencing a cleanup and seeing it, it's a very visceral reaction, and it makes you think twice.
Why don't you give a recap of how people can get in touch with you and what they can do?
Absolutely. You can go to volunteercleanup.org, and you can sign up as a volunteer so that you receive alerts every Monday morning of cleanups in your area. If you'd like to organize a cleanup of your own, you can use the tools and resources on our website to do that. And you can also work on your individual role in reducing single-use plastics. Carry your own bottle, bring your own bags to the store, and skip straws at restaurants.
You said that Dave Dobler, your partner in this, is chair of the Sustainability Committee on Miami Beach. What is that?
Correct. So it is a citizen-led group that helps to make recommendations for sustainability and resiliency practices within the city of Miami Beach. They have direct contact and collaboration with the commissioners to do things like the styrofoam ban, to impose stricter fines for littering, to do the piloting of the storm grading. So we're able to have a lot of influence and bring new ideas to the tables. And we're very fortunate to have a commission that is supportive of what we're trying to do to be a greener city.
Well, we want to thank you very much. Dara Schoenwald is a cultural anthropologist. She's an eco-activist and a social entrepreneur. She's the executive director and co-founder with Dave Dobler of volunteercleanup.org. That's volunteercleanup.org. And it's been informative, and it's an important organization. So we wish you all the best.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here.
Food and Dining is next.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Bonnie Berman and Joseph Cooper.
Let's go cleaning up this weekend.
Yeah, I think it's a really good idea. Yeah. Excellent. Well, here's a quote from Dave Barry about today's food and dining topic.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
Well, we know it's going to be funny.
Yes, go ahead.
Your hand and your mouth agreed many years ago that as far as chocolate is concerned, there's no need to involve your brain. So with us now is chef, author, syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer. Linda, over the years, we've heard plenty about your fanatic love of desserts, and especially the rich, chocolatey ones.
There's an adjective there I was worried about, this fanatic.
Fanatically?
Yes.
Okay, well, we're not taking it out.
I don't think you can at the moment.
No.
Okay, so let's talk about this. Diving into a piece of chocolate cake, and the best part's licking the frosting. What do you think about that?
Sounds good.
Or how about biting into a rich chocolate fudgy brownie? That's fanatic. Okay. So.
Or just fudge.
All right.
Or your chocolate mousse.
Okay. All of the above. Well, as one of my friends told me, it's not a coincidence that chocolate and gold are sold in bars. So, chocolate fans, this is your weekend. Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden is having their chocolate festival, and here to tell us more about it is Richard Campbell. He's the horticultural director at Fairchild. Let's welcome Richard Campbell. Hello, Richard.
Hello. How are you all doing?
We're fine. He's joining us by phone because he's so busy at the garden getting ready.
He's busier than Willy Wonka.
I'm eating chocolate, really, so yeah. That's what I'm doing.
Richard, it's strange not to see you with a knife cutting a mango.
I know. Well, you know, it's just trust me, I still have the knife, but I just use it to cut up chocolate bars now.
Okay.
That's what I'm doing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, also with us is Chef Alan Susser. He's going to give us some secrets about choosing, tasting, and cooking with chocolate. And he's also going to be giving a cooking demonstration at the festival. So let's welcome Chef Alan Susser.
Well, thank you. A pleasure to be here with you.
It's our pleasure. We've got chocolate right here in the studio.
It's the best place to be.
You can almost cut it.
Next to the chocolate.
Absolutely. Well, of course, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any chocolate questions for our guests? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Radio at WLRN.org is the email.
Right. And of course, with us is Fred Tasker, the wine columnist, our friend Fred. He's joining us by Skype. And you can read Fred's wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes columns in the Miami Herald. And you can also read his wine column in the Saturday Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking?
Well, what do you think? Wine with chocolate? Is that a possibility? We'll have to talk about it.
I'll bet it is with you. Okay. I'm drooling. I'm drinking chocolate while we're talking. Chocolate Festival this weekend, January 22nd, 23rd, 24th. Tell us a little bit about what's happening there.
Well, what we're going to have for that is, I mean, it's just what we've been talking about. It's everything chocolate. We are very much this year really excited because we're delving into the world of chocolate growers, dealing with the worldwide crisis that is chocolate. And
well, I have to stop you right there. Mm-hmm. You're going to make everybody upset. What do you mean by a worldwide crisis with chocolate?
Well, it's why everybody has to come to Chocolate Festival, because, you know, we are facing a worldwide shortage of chocolate that will, it's on the way. Everyone is working very hard to head it off and to make it less severe.
What's causing it?
There are a complex of diseases out there in the cacao world that has caused all of the countries that used to be net exporters of chocolate are now net importers of chocolate. So everyone competes, leaving only Africa as the main continent that still is free of these diseases. And so what we have to do is basically solve the biological problem of these diseases before we cause chocolate to real shortages to occur.
So do we have to start hoarding chocolate now? Am I going to have to go straight to the store?
I'm just thinking, you know, if we talk about it, I figure, you know, Linda, that you're probably getting very upset and you're thinking about, you know, going and buying up all the chocolate and putting it in the safe somewhere. But it's not that bad. I mean, this is one of the real exciting things. Here in Miami, we have the scientists and the technology and the genetic resources in order to answer the question. It's just going to take really good horticultural scientific work in order to resolve these things. So we'll do it. I mean, it'll happen. We'll fix it. But it really is a serious problem, and there's a lot of very big companies putting money into this.
And, well, I'll bet.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So Chef Allen's sitting here and he's nodding his head yes, because Chef, you have a chocolate farmer. You work with a chocolate farmer.
I do, in St. Lucia. St. Lucia, chocolate grows throughout the tropics. And in the Caribbean, St. Lucia, I work with a farm, Jade Mountain, and the farm is actually called Emerald Estate. And we have about 1,000 cacao trees there. And from the cacao tree is where it's the fruit of that tree that we make chocolate from. Mm-hmm. And Richard is right. We do see that happening. But on the brighter side, making chocolate is a lot of fun. I'll tell you what, because you're getting these big, huge pods of wonderful seeds and beans, and you dry, you harvest it and then ferment it. And fermenting the chocolate, after that, you dry it. It dries into a wonderful dark bean. And then this dark bean gets roasted, and that's when you start to smell that real rich, cocoa-y, chocolatey sort of flavor to it, though it has no sugar yet. After you what you do is you crack it and throw the shell away. It's called winnowing.
You've got some here.
I have some that I actually brought in from St. Lucia. And you can
and
smell the beautiful aromatics
right.
of how how sweet that smells, or chocolatey.
It does.
Then you crack it and grind it, and you grind it with sugar. And so in that grinding process, you're actually grinding it almost for about 36 or more hours.
Oh.
Just to...
They look like pecans.
Yeah. Well, you can crack that open. That's soft enough because it's roasted. You can crack it open. You have what we call a chocolate nib, which is the cocoa and the cocoa butter all in the same place.
Richard, what is chocolate horticulturally?
It's Theobroma cacao. It is, as Chef Allen was saying, it's native to the Amazon basin, and it is on a small tree, fruit in pods.
So it is a fruit.
Yeah, it's a fruit, and then we're just eating the seeds of that fruit, and when you can actually the flesh was what we as kids we would suck on it. It's just a sweet gelatinous flesh around those seeds. We didn't have the technology nor the patience to try to grind anything for 36 hours, you know, when I was
But that flesh is delicious, Richard.
It's very good.
And,
yeah.
and Bonnie, by the way, is if you hear the cracking sound, she's cracking the nibs
cracked
right
one
now.
Open. So and is there anything in this you can...
Yeah, you can...
You can eat it.
Chocolate nibs, which is kind of like the nutty part, if you take that out, that's what is that chocolatey flavor, which... Again, I'm part of my demonstration this weekend. I'm going to be using those nibs in a chocolate pancake, an exotic chocolate pancake with the chocolate nibs. But also taking that is what I made the chocolate tea that we're tasting
right now. Let's talk about that for a minute, because first of all, if you go to the Fairchild Gardens this weekend for their chocolate festival, you can learn all about chocolate. You can take a chocolate walk and all of that. And then there's going to be several cooking demonstrations. But Chef Allen, when are you going to be there demonstrating?
I'm going to demonstrate on Sunday afternoon, about 1 o'clock.
And what do you, now, we said there's chocolate here. So we've been drinking this chocolate. Before we get to the chocolate pancakes, which I want to know all about, tell me what I'm drinking here.
It's got some kick to it.
Okay. So the chocolate tea is really the traditional way that chocolate was consumed here in the Americas before Columbus. It dates back that long. So this chocolate tea that I've made here has the chocolate itself that's ground with a little bit of sugar.
It's but very, it also very has thick and very
cinnamon.
Chocolatey.
Yeah, because it has cinnamon and cloves, a little bit of star anise and bay leaf. So it has some really wonderful, powerful aromatics, as well as the chocolate itself. This chocolate from St. Lucia, from Emerald Estate, is a very aromatic, fruity chocolate. And that's kind of what you want to look for when you're talking about chocolate. It's not just candy. We're not talking about candy here. We're talking about aromatics and flavors and fruitiness and earthiness. And so that in this tea, this chocolate tea, you've got all of these flavors and warming it up, and it is thick. Because
it's very thick.
Yeah.
And I could go for a little more sugar in it.
It's, oh, no.
It's pretty puckery.
By the way, cacao is in here. Yeah.
How much cacao? Well, if you see the
what
stick
percentage?
Here.
Well, yeah.
I just want to say to everybody that the recipe for this is on my website.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Dinnerinminutes.com. But go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So traditionally, it's you take those nibs and those spices and roll it almost like a Play-Doh into this stick. So that
so he's got here
like
a stick of chocolate.
Like a cigar.
Like a cigar. It's about an inch thick and about 7 or 8 inches long.
So it's a big chocolate cigar without sugar. Exactly. It does not have sugar. It does not have the sweetness. So that you can add as much sugar as you want or as necessary. But chocolate tea traditionally is not a sweet drink, but it's flavorful. It has a little bit of sugar in it, and it's actually consumed throughout the Caribbean. That's wherever the English were, because it was a tea. So that's how they kind of utilized
it. So before we go to a break, I want to talk about these chocolate pancakes. Tell us about the chocolate pancakes.
Okay, so you know, pancakes are pancakes, but I'm doing these with a little twist. So I'm using quinoa flour and whole wheat flour as the base of these. And then also taking these chocolate nibs. The chocolate nibs are taking the chocolate directly from the process of making the processing the bean. And so you have all the aromatics and the flavors of chocolate without any sweetness. And so that the chocolate nibs, it's not like putting chocolate chips into a chocolate chip pancake. This is chocolate chips where you're getting all the big, powerful aromas and roasted chocolate flavor into these pancakes. And with the quinoa and the whole wheat flour, a little bit of milk
and
egg.
When you're cooking them, how do you... I know that you can buy some chocolate nibs that have sugar in them. You can buy them in the supermarket. So if we were going to make these pancakes, and you're making... How do you keep the chocolate from sinking to the bottom of the pancake or melting in the pancake before it's finished? Give us the tip here.
Right. Well, again, it's a thicker batter, and in the thick batter, you also have a little bit of milk and egg, and so that it incorporates in by not putting too much into it, and again, stirring your overall batter till you put and make pancakes out of it. So this is kind of like in the style of a Johnny cake.
What do you top it with? Yeah.
Then topping with, since I'm serving it with the chocolate tea, I'm actually putting nice crushed 70% chocolate cacao on top of that and some walnuts. If I wasn't going to serve with the tea, I would actually make a spiced chocolate sauce with the chocolate with a little bit of cinnamon and cloves and nutmeg.
Hope everybody is drooling while we go to a break now. I'm drooling, I know. So I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and my guests today are Fairchild Gardens' Richard Campbell and Chef Alan Susser. We're talking chocolate, in case you didn't realize that. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and our guests today are Fairchild Garden Horticultural Director Richard Campbell and Chef Alan Susser. And they've been telling us about the Chocolate Festival at Fairchild this weekend and giving us a lesson on growing, choosing cooking with chocolate. And we've been enjoying chocolate right here in the studio. But right now, it's Dinner in Minutes time. And it's a little bit chilly this week, so I thought we'd have a really quick and easy soup. It's a pasta and bean soup, better known as pasta e fagioli. And the recipe is for two, but you can increase it for a crowd. It's really, really simple. I use rinsed and canned cannellini beans, some canned tomatoes with their juice, some celery, garlic, and chicken broth, and water, and you just add that to the saucepan, and you bring it to a boil. and just simmer it for about 10 minutes. Then I add some small cut pasta. I use the pasta called Acini di Pepe, which is a soup pasta, but any kind of small pasta will do. In fact, you could even use whatever pasta you've got left over, little bits and pieces in your cupboard there. Then you can just break it into small pieces and put it in the soup. Cook it for 8 minutes, and that's it. A little fresh basil, a little Parmesan cheese, and you're done. Serve it with a salad. And if you wanted to make it a vegetarian dish, you could use vegetable broth instead of chicken broth. Now, and you could also make it in advance, and if you do, then leave out the pasta and add it just 10 minutes before you're going to serve it to cook in the soup. So that recipe and a photo, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. And you can also find Chef Allen's chocolate, Caribbean chocolate tea. Is that what it's called,
That's
Chef?
That's right.
Caribbean chocolate tea that we've been enjoying here. It's on the website, dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter, at L. Gassenheimer. Okay, Fred, what are we going to drink with our chocolate?
Linda, as you, I'm sure you know, since the new year arrived, I've been urging wine fans to broaden their palates and try new wines. And this is the perfect opportunity for that. So let's look into what kind of wine goes with chocolate.
All right, let's go.
Now, chocolate is powerful stuff. At the same time, it's sweet and it's bitter and acidic and fruity. So it won't go with any light-bodied wine, any dry wine, and certainly not any white wine. To me, the perfect wine for chocolate is powerful red port. You don't have to
Chef
spend
Allen's
a lot of money
saying
there.
Yes. He's raising
I'm with you there.
Oh, good. Glad to hear it. Maybe a young, inexpensive ruby port. It doesn't have to be more than $15, $20 a bottle. Now, ruby port is a lot like chocolate. It's sweet and it's bitter and it's acidic and fruity, so it's a natural pairing. But even then, I wouldn't have port with a Hershey bar because milk chocolate is just too bland for port. It's not chocolate enough. You want top quality adult chocolate, bittersweet chocolate with a cocoa content of up to 70%, and it's just a wonderful combination. So, or you could try it with intensely chocolate desserts like molten lava chocolate cake. Or I make a bundt cake that people like. It's called Too Much Chocolate Cake, and it's made with...
So you've gotten away from your lobster now. We're into chocolate cake. Okay.
We're into chocolate cake, so Linda, this is right up your alley.
Okay, let's hear it. What's in it?
It's made with double fudge cake mix, instant chocolate pudding, and bittersweet chocolate chips with chocolate frosting. Pour it, and you've got heaven.
And you're making it with the cake mix. Okay, sounds
absolutely
good.
Yeah, I don't do these things from scratch. That's too much work.
Okay. Chef Allen says he loves it. Okay, go ahead.
On the other hand, if you really want to challenge your palate, try chocolate with beer. How does that sound, Linda?
I don't know. Isn't there a chocolate beer we had one time on the show?
Yeah, you don't want any just any beer. You don't want a wimpy light beer, but there's a brewery in Oregon called Rogue, and it makes a chocolate stout. It actually adds chocolate to the malt before fermenting the beer.
And chefs, you're
yeah, I think that's a great idea. A stout would really pick up the aspects of the aromatics really well.
Yeah, it's a nice combination. You can make it yourself if you're a home brewer. You just add broken up pieces of bittersweet baker's chocolate or chocolate chips or candy bars or even chocolate syrup. Then you have to superheat it to boil off the fat laden cocoa butter, and then you go ahead with the fermentation. So, and not surprisingly, that goes wonderfully with chocolate. Although what I tried it with, I tried the Rogue's chocolate stout at a party one time, and I poured a glass of it and plopped in a couple of scoops of Reese's peanut butter ice cream and made a really delicious, not too sweet, sophisticated, very adult ice cream float. And that was really heaven.
Well, would you try that, Chef? Reese's Pieces and
I'm with you, Fred. Let me know when. We'll try it together.
I'm ready.
It's a new year. We should all try something new.
Yeah, that's our New Year's resolution.
There you are.
Okay, sounds good. Richard Campbell, you're going to be selling some cocoa trees or some, at the festival. Is that right?
Correct. We have cacao plants for sale.
But also, I've read about this a chocolate-smelling orchid. What's that all about?
The Sherry Baby Orchid is also known as the chocolate orchid, and if you smell it, you will understand exactly what... It's a Oncidium. It's a beautiful orchid in its own right, but it actually smells like dark chocolate. I mean, it has a wonderful, wonderful chocolate aroma. And
I never heard that an orchid had any scent at all.
I presume that's not edible.
It's not edible, but it is. It makes you hungry. It makes you want chocolate. I'll tell you that. And it also grows very, very well here in South Florida. It's one that you can mount in a tree, and it'll keep blooming. It'll actually bloom multiple times per year, and will survive forever. I mean, it's really a very well adapted orchid for South Florida.
And that's really? Sherry Baby, like the song?
Correct. Okay. Sherry Baby.
You know, Richard, I thought Oncidiums needed a lot cooler weather than we have here.
No. This one is so well adapted. This was bred in South Florida, and it's a very, very good orchid for here. And it's a wonderful. I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer orchid. You know, put it up in a tree and don't baby it, and it'll take care of itself. It's very nice.
You don't have to water it or spray it in the winter here?
Nope. Mm-hmm. Nope.
Oh, maybe I could even do it, huh, Richard?
Linda, it's a perfect orchid for you. It's a perfect orchid.
There are some great fragrant orchids, though, Linda. There are cattleyas that are amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Wonderful. They're tremendous. And isn't vanilla an orchid?
Correct. Vanilla is an orchid,
really?
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. The orchid is a very useful family for us. I just, you know. I always talk about mangoes. I don't talk about orchids.
Richard has always tried to make me a gardener. He's not having a lot of success, but we can keep trying, Richard.
We're gonna make it happen.
Okay.
Richard had to drop the mango word on this
conversation. No, I cannot speak. You know, of course I had to say that. You know me, Alan.
I do.
Yeah. And you know, with the cacao plants themselves, the big key to them in South Florida is you have to plant them in a protected space, a lot of water, a lot of fertilizer, very good protection, so protection from the cold and the wind, and no salt, so, you know, can't be near the ocean or getting any salt spray. And then you can grow your own cacao plants here in South Florida. You might not like want to do that and make your own chocolate because it's a little challenging to do that, but you definitely can produce pods in a couple years. And the cacao pod itself is very beautiful. We always use them to decorate the tables, and they're great conversation pieces, and, you know.
So you wouldn't be opening it up and letting it and cooking it for 36 hours or grating it or something?
I've tried it. I've tried that, but I'm not. The big problem is the fermentation process. When you ferment cacao to make chocolate, the fermentation is the real key to flavor development.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Well, we're almost out of time. It's really been a very, very tasty week. I think everybody now is drooling about chocolate. Yeah. Richard Campbell, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And good luck this weekend. He's the horticultural director at Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden. And if you want to know more about it, you can go to I Love Chocolate at Fairchild Garden for more information, or just call the garden. And Chef Alan Susser, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, and I'll see you down at the gardens this weekend.
Yes.
Absolutely.
He's going to be doing his demonstration at 1 o'clock on Sunday.
And thank you for the chocolate tea. Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yes.
My pleasure.
And
I loved it.
And if you go there, you can have his chocolate pancakes.
Thanks.
Anyway, Bonnie Berman, Joe Cooper, great to be with you.
Likewise, thank you.
Fred Tasker, great advice as always. I like that chocolate cake.
Mm-hmm.
Chef Alan, if Linda's there, you better bring some extra chocolate.
Oh, thanks, Fred.
I'm prepared for her.
Well, next week we're going to be talking with Adele Sandberg and Cheryl Lynn Adler from Earpiece, PEACE Foundation, about a topic so many people have asked me about, noise level in restaurants. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for joining us today. Our Shoreline Debris segment was produced by Polly Landis. Additional assistance, of course, from lead producer Richard Ives. And as usual, we have free audio downloads available at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Bonnie and I return Monday to discuss retirement. No, not ours. Especially the often difficult financial side to it. In today's economy, many people must continue working past the age of 65. We'll have a panel of experts on hand to talk about the key issues faced by many in the boomer generation. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Linda Gastenheimer, Fred Tasker, Richard Campbell, Chef Allen, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.